Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome to the KE Report Weekend Show. Corey and Chad here, your host for this weekend show. This weekend show is going to be very much focused on commodities. The first half of the show, we're going to focus more on the metals sector. We're seeing breakouts in gold, the gold stocks, even silver and copper have been doing very well. Back half of the show, going to be more in terms of the energy sector, oil and natural gas. Natural gas continuing to do well, oil maybe trying to find a bottom here. Within this whole show, we're also going to be tying in comments on companies where some of our guests and analysts see opportunities. Just as a reminder, everyone, please go back, visit our website, visit our podcast. Just search the KE Report in your podcast player and visit our YouTube channel, also our new Substack page to keep up to date with everything that we're doing. Please like, comment, and subscribe and share it with all of your friends. Without further ado, let's get into the metal side of this show, chatting with Joe Mazumdar. Joe is the editor of Exploration Insights. Joe, just as a broad comment, as I said on the intro there, gold breaking above 3,000. GDX recently broke to levels we haven't seen since 2012/2013. Silver is up over $34, and even copper ran to over $5. We seem to be seeing precious metals and commodities diverge from the broad averages. Joe, out of these breakouts that I just mentioned, which ones have your attention?
Well, thank you for that. I mean, I'm going to do a review of the 2024 results from producers, about 20 companies this weekend for subscribers. I mean, the cumulative market cap of these 20 companies would be like $225 billion. The top eight companies that I'm looking at, mostly North American listed, produce about a third of the 2024 global gold production, about 68 million ounces. In 2024, like you said, gold price did really well, but you know, the GDX, GDXJ lagged a bit. That's not the case in 2025, as we're seeing more leverage to the gold price right now, as people are talking about gold. Like, I don't know about you, but you know, when I look at ads now, a lot more ads are about gold. Even on the radio, people are talking about gold. And there's a bit of a divergence between people that are looking for gold just for gold as something to have, and that might not translate to equities. But there's this other part that, you know, the uncertainty created by the current administration on potential recession fears have put a lot of institutional equity into big gold equities, which have done much better in 2025 than last year. And so in my review, I'm going to be looking at basically, you know, how they've been doing in terms of margins, which have improved, in terms of balance sheet, which looks better, but then also which ones are like lined up to grow through M&A. And I would probably stress this might be more the intermediates and hopefully coming down to single asset developers eventually.
Well, Joe, just to that last point you made about growth, that's been something we've been talking about a lot on the show for a while, that we're not seeing a lot of that in the majors, but the intermediates, the mid-tiers that you mentioned, they actually have the ability to actually grow on a percentage basis a little bit more by doing a bolt-on acquisition, an M&A deal, or bringing in a development project, just because they're smaller companies. How are you looking at growth in the majors versus growth in the intermediates?
So out of these 20 companies, what I did in terms of labeling growth, I said, well, we've got, you know, measured and indicated resources that can be converted into reserves, and then you get inferred. So I assumed that the measured and indicated were being used to calculate reserves. And so in terms of growth metric, I took what I call total mineral inventory, which would be measured, indicated, and inferred, and took inferred over that total number. And the average of those 20 companies was about, let's see, about 27%, let's say 25 to 30% if you talked about growth. But there's a wide divergence in terms of growth. The bigger you are, the harder it is to show that kind of level of growth. And you're right, the intermediates coming off a smaller base can show more growth. But then also, as we look in terms of what they're doing with the extra cash that they're making, The bigger companies are issuing dividends, stable dividends, hopefully, and that will attract generalists. The intermediates are looking more for growth and merger of equals, like we just saw Equinox and Caliber, those kind of acquisitions to grow and get to that next level where you gain liquidity, lower your cost of capital. There might be more of that M&A coming up as well. But then I'm wanting to see if we start seeing some of these developers actually get acquired as well. We saw, Sabina get acquired by B2 several years ago. That was a challenging project to build. That might have dissuaded a few people from buying single asset developers, even though they were technically cheap. But I should think that with what's happening in the States and, the ability to permit, people might look more into the States for M&A.
Joe, let's keep talking about this a little bit because it is one thing that I've been disappointed about is on the bigger end of these companies, production growth just is not there. It's flat, if not declining. And quite frankly, in the environment that we have right now, these companies should be producing more. They can take advantage of these higher gold prices. But I understand the argument that last major bull market, these companies grew for the sake of growth and the metals price turned around on them and they struggled. But without this growth, it's hard to say that these stocks are growth stocks. I mean, okay, maybe they're income stocks, but their dividends are still generally low. So then on the reserve side of things, don't these companies have projects in the background that they have written off in prior years that they could bring back into the mix and say, look, at least we're increasing our reserves. In essence, what I'm saying is, why isn't somebody shifting more to focusing on growth in this better pricing environment rather than simply consistently trying to cut costs, which is hurting their production growth?
So what I've seen is there's not a lot of reserve growth in the bigger companies and even some intermediates without M&A. They require the M&A to grow, especially on the reserve side, but also in some of these guys in the total mineral inventory. They're not technically growing, and that might be due to the lack of exploration, and they basically cut exploration out maybe, and now they're just looking at growth through M&A because it might be cheaper. Yeah, like I did a bit of a metric on proportion of revenue spent on G&A, exploration, and finance, and the average on the proportion of revenue for G&A was about 3%, and that was about the same as for exploration. So on average, these 20 companies that I looked at are spending 3% of their revenue on exploration. Some of them are not spending any on exploration, which suggests that they're only looking to grow through M&A. And there's more than one of those sort of companies. Like Pan American Silver would be one of those sort of style of companies that's more into M&A than they are into exploration. So I think some of this is due to the lack of exploration. That's also why we see more of this industry funding the juniors, and that's their form of exploration, that they fund juniors to explore. The juniors do it. It's cheaper for the major. They don't have to bring on anybody. And if they like it, they eventually acquire it. But technically, they're following the project and helping them progress. So that's another form of growing through exploration, but not technically doing exploration internally.
Well, Joe, I'm glad you went there because that's exactly what I was going to ask you is the strategic positions we've seen from larger companies into the juniors to back their exploration programs and let the juniors be the exploration workhorse. There's a lot of nuance around this. I'd love to get your thoughts on. There's some companies that have taken out a position through only equity, and there's other ones that take it over on a project level where they're getting an earn-in and a joint venture agreement or an option agreement. And then there's some companies that continually participate, but there's other companies waving the flag that a major's invested with them, but they haven't done anything for 6 years or 8 years. So how do you look at strategic investments from the producers into the juniors?
It's an excellent question and it's very complicated. I used to work in corporate development for Newmont. So, one thing that I look at when somebody has an equity stake, the first thing I look at was how they actually got that equity stake. Because sometimes what happens with an equity stake is it's you bought the project off of a major, you couldn't pay them cash, and so they ended up with an equity stake. And so, for me, that's like a passive stake. That might be an overhang. So once I eliminate that, that's good. I want proactive investment. And it's nice that they have whatever 9.9 or 19.9, which would be, great in one sense, but also bad in terms of, potential M&A. There, you might only have a single bidder, so there is that other part of it. The problem with the equity stake when you're dealing with like a big project that requires a lot of expenditures, once industry, takes that 9.9 or 19.9%, and they're a bit handcuffed in terms of what they can do going forward, they've given you whatever it was out of your company. Maybe it was only 3 or 4 million for that 9.9%, but you've got this big copper exploration program and you've already spent their money. And now, yes, you own 100% of your project, but you've got to constantly go back to the equity markets. And if you don't hit that good hole within 12 to 18 months, you might be raising at a lower price. So, if you find a project that's 25% of what a major copper project looks like, that's quite a significant deposit. And if you're only trading at 20 or $30 million market cap, it might be a better to do it at the project level than do it at the equity level, especially for projects that require a lot of funding over a long term. I prefer the project level. I prefer an earn-in that way because retail markets can be fickle. And if you don't get that drill hole that the markets like within the 12 to 18 months, and maybe you get that nice alteration hole that looks like you're close to something, the major realizes that and they continue to fund you, whereas retail might not continue to fund you on that result because technically they don't get it. So for those sort of things, I prefer that the investor has the same wave as the actual exploration program. And that wave is a long wave. And so you need long wave money. You can't have short-term wave money. That's why, we're constantly diluting these juniors and, they blow their share structure out.
Oh, we've seen that in so many different companies. But unfortunately, exploration is expensive, time consuming, and that just leads to blown out share structures. But having those partners does help. So, Joe, with this research that you've done that I know you're sharing with your subscribers, I think shortly after this interview will go live on the weekend. Are there any companies that are standing out to you that are offering some growth that have some good growth profiles? It's personally something that I'm looking for. I want companies that can take advantage of these higher metals prices right now because everybody benefits from the higher metals prices, but I want to see some growth in the sector. So, do you have any companies you can share with me that you think are on that growth path that could satisfy what I'm looking for?
Well, when I did this, I was more interested probably from the take on M&A, like who would go acquire the companies that I have in my portfolio. Because the letter is Exploration Insight, so we deal more with the juniors than the majors in terms of saying, oh, hey, I really like, whatever, Agnico Eagle or something like that. What has been strange, I will note, is that usually when the gold price goes up, it's the leverage is usually provided by those companies that are on the cusp that have very low margins under lower prices, but their margin expands on a percentage basis significantly when the gold price moves because they're more of the higher cost companies, like your Equinox, let's say. But what I've noticed, like last year, Lundin Gold did ridiculously well. That was one of the better ones. They went up 70%, and they're already low cost. They generate a lot of free cash flow. They paid off their debt. They're doing everything right, and ridiculously, the market's rewarding them. And usually, the market doesn't reward people that well for doing everything right. So that surprised me. Another one that did quite well and low cost that's growing. And found some, and developing a new project in Serbia, I would put Dundee Precious Metals, and they're doing well. And then the market is rewarding them as well. They're low cost, higher grade, they deal with more complex metallurgy. But yeah, they've done quite well. But even with the increase in the gold price and the buoyancy of 2024, still it could be problematic. Like, the issues with West Africa and Mali really hit Barrick, and also hit B2 Gold, as well as their issues with developing Goose, which I think is now coming into commercial production. I think they're organizing a site visit and announcing the commercial production on that one. So even with the gold price rise, it doesn't necessarily float all boats if you're dealing with capital escalation or a geopolitical risk.
Well, Joe, let's talk a little bit more about geopolitical risk or the lack thereof. There's different jurisdictions that have people's interests, but you mentioned at the onset that the U.S. may become a better jurisdiction than previous just because the idea being the red tape being removed, that less restriction, faster permitting, maybe more government support on getting these projects built. When you look across them, we can open it up to other metals, whether it's gold or silver or copper. How are you looking at the U.S. as a jurisdiction in light of maybe reduced restrictions?
Okay, so there's a few things about the US. So I would say one thing, yes, on the permitting, I don't think there'll be a lot of NGOs coming in at the last minute and trying to scutter things. And maybe they get less weight because it seemed to me that under the Biden administration, they sort of rolled over for some of these NGOs. I don't think that would happen under this administration. But that doesn't mean that the NGOs still won't slow things down. They might not get them revoked like they did with the road for a trilogy when they had the permit, then they took the permit away. But they might still slow down the process. But what I would say, another factor in the US is because they're like reducing the government employees, some of that has hit the permitting of ground on BLM or US Forestry Service. So just permitting drill programs because there's less people to talk to. And you don't know who to talk to, and there's less people that are, dealing with more permits. So it's not all great in terms of that. And another thing I'd point out is that, the cost of drilling in the States has, especially in the West, has gone up quite a bit. So when I was there maybe a year ago, it was $450 US per meter. We're not talking about helicopters, we're talking about road access. Not complicated logistics, but that 450 is probably more like $500 a meter for core, which is not cheap. And it's not only labor, it's piping, it's a whole bunch of things. And so that's a little bit of an anomaly. And so I think a lot more people in the West are going to be doing reverse circulation now until they find something and they can request, I mean, get a bigger equity raise to drill a diamond. But I've seen, some of these companies that are dealing with critical minerals, even in the States, that, are having a hard time getting funded. And some of the problem here is bang for buck, because logistically, some of these companies that require 800, 1,000 plus dollars per meter to drill, the investors look at them and go, well, now you've only got money for a 3,000 meter program. And that's not a lot of news flow. And if you miss, you're going to be back here asking for another 3 to 5 million just to drill another 1,500, 2,000 meters. And this is going to take forever. And your window is very short. And so there is a bit of that as well. And then the other leading I would say is that the delta between critical and security, which we might have discussed before, is, it's not, they're not about energy transition metals. That's not their focus. Their focus is on security minerals that they could see themselves having an issue with. And that would be antimony, rare earths. Now they're trying to protect their steel and aluminum industry. They're trying to protect copper. And so if you could produce that domestically, that's important. But if anybody knows anything about the soup to nuts in this, is that the processing, there's still a processing gap in the States in terms of copper smelters, aluminum smelters, what have you. And so even though they, if even if they find a mine like a copper mine, if that copper mine is producing concentrate, the chances it's going to get smelted in the States is very low. So it's got to be sent overseas. And as we know, 50% of the smelting capacity is in China. So there's where you get a little bit of an advantage for some companies, like I would specifically say, like a company like Arizona Sonora Copper in Arizona, developing the Cactus Park Salyer project, which they switched from mostly underground to open pit, lowered the grade somewhat, but that's all solvent extraction electrowinning. on oxide and enriched material that would get them cathode and not copper concentrate. So that cathode would go straight into the market, straight into copper rod manufacturing, copper wire, right into the cars that they're manufacturing in the States. So you got to still be a little bit nuanced in terms of how you make your selections here in the current environment.
That's very interesting, Joe, because I have noticed a lot of US-focused copper plays doing better. And a lot of it does seem to be on that whole more positive outlook for permitting. But what you're saying here is don't just go blindly into any US copper play. It needs to be unique because of that whole refining aspect. Can you give us just a little bit more info on this and why maybe some of these other copper plays just don't at least make sense in the here and now environment?
Yeah, the problem with a lot of these big copper projects, which are attractive in terms of, pounds, billions of pounds, let's say 20 to 30 year mine life, let's say, they cost a lot. The capital intensity of a lot of these projects is very high. And it could be like you can have lower labor in some of these Andean projects, but logistically, you're up to 5,000 meters. There's not a lot of infrastructure. And so the capital intensity is quite high. And that's some of what they dealt with at Quebrada Blanca too. And that's got a lot of people scared. And so even though the copper price is going up more so probably because of the potential imposition of tariffs on copper imports into the States and potential implications for the global economy, but still I would say that developers, producers, anybody looking to build a project needs a higher copper price to incentivize them to build in this environment of higher input costs, because it's harder for them to get cheaper Chinese goods now. And so they're going to have to pay for more expensive goods from potential Western supply chains, which might not come at the same, speed and be more expensive. And also, the quality of the Chinese stuff has come up quite a bit in the last 2 decades. So it might be the Western stuff that might be a worse quality now than the Chinese stuff. So that capital intensity is an issue everywhere, and especially in industrial metals like copper, and you do need a higher price to incentivize people to build. But the people that are already producing, the people that have lower cost production projects potentially that make sense, those people can take advantage of this market. And with Arizona Sonora, just getting back to that one, that's probably the window that Hudbay Minerals looked at, because they're already in Arizona's building their project Copper World, which looks very similar to Cactus Park Salyer, and they want to eventually produce a copper cathode as well. But their way of producing copper cathode is basically leaching the copper concentrate, and fine grinding it, ultra fine grinding it to leach it to produce copper cathode. Arizona Sonora metallurgically is not that complicated.
Well, Joe, just to that point, you mentioned to us off mic that you think this Hudbay positioning in Arizona Sonoran, and we've had the company on the show a number of times, so I think our audience is up to speed on it. But you think it's more significant even than the Rio, the Nuton technology, just from the standpoint of kind of a vote of confidence and a vetting by Hudbay. Maybe unpack that a little bit more on this particular company.
Okay, so I think there's a few things. So when Nuton came in, it was good because this was, a microcap story, had a Rio Tinto subsidiary that was putting their stamp of approval on the project. But when Nuton comes in, their stamp of approval is not really a stamp of approval on development, permitting, all of that. It's more about stamp of approval to say, you know what? I think your copper mineralization would work well with our technology, which is, basically some, BioOx on the copper. And, they need a certain amount of sulfides, mostly pyrite, to keep the bugs happy. And it doesn't work for every deposit, but, their incentive is to give you money to test your product, which is your mineralization, your resource, to see if it works. But the way the deal was structured, they came in with equity, which was great. It was like at market premium, whatever. And then you get a big name into a company in terms of a junior. But Hudbay is more important because they're developers and producers, and they're already building a project in Arizona. So to have their stamp of approval is even more important. And also because Nuton, their technology was going to be working on the sulfides. And the sulfides right now, in terms of Arizona Sonora Park Salyer Project, are not coming in anytime soon in terms of the mine life. And so their impact on the net present value of that project is much less because by the time they bring in the sulfides, it might be year 10 plus, and that dollar is worth 50 cents. And so their impact on the overall project, the IRR and payback will be insignificant. But if you get somebody like Hudbay coming in, cost of capital will be much reduced, potential synergies between the two projects. I think that looks like a better fit in terms of being more important with respect to private placements and stamps of approval.
That's so interesting, Joe. And what do you think of these new technologies? It does seem like there are some majors out there developing some technologies. I want to get your opinion on the balance between these technologies either improving economics at potential new mines, or what I'm hearing a lot of too is that these technologies can extend mine lives. We keep hearing about how some of these major copper mines are nearing the end of their mine lives, and that's where we're going to see this big shortfall. Where do you see these new technologies playing the biggest role in the copper space?
So, electrification is a big one in terms of trucks and remote underground. That's another one where they have technology that will give you communication way deep underground. And so when we talk about remote, we're not talking about a remote operator that's maybe 50 meters, 100 meters from the actual machine. They're like a kilometer up at surface operating it. Like they're online. And so productivity increases. You need less, there's less issues about diesel and that underground because there's no humans down there. So that's another technology in terms of, a productivity increase. There's metallurgy is a big one because we've taken a lot of rock above the ground and call it waste or low-grade stockpile, but some of these things have elements in them that suddenly, with the Chinese bans on some metals, they might have them there. And so you could see some of that happening in Zambia as people are looking at the old tailings and that and seeing if they can get gallium and germanium out of those because they're already, milled and fine-grained and see if they can extract those. So people are looking at what they can do with what's already up there as well. But when you develop bigger and bigger open pits that go deeper and deeper, like when I was with Phelps Dodge, this was a while ago, but things people don't think about, like high angle conveyors. And those things were very important back then, more than 20 years ago, because they reduced the amount of trucks going down the pit, because those trucks, as the pit got deeper, would take hours to get to the top. And so if you had a high angle conveyor that could take, stuff from the pits and then right to the surface, that was going to be faster and already reduce your diesel consumption. And so those sort of things are the things that we don't hear about or, normally, because that's where the big companies are spending a lot of their money. They've got an active operation, it's going deeper, or they have issues with diesel underground. They have to build a new ventilation shaft that might, be 1.5 kilometers, but hey, why don't we do it remote? And we won't have to worry about, the diesel particulate matter underground because there won't be any people down there.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how these technologies are used to advance projects that maybe weren't economic before but could be now, or extend mine life to Corey's point, or just improve processing recoveries. A lot going on. It's nice to see some innovation in the mining sector. You brought up an interesting point there, though, Joe, about some of these co-credit metals. We hear a lot about this, and we could broaden this discussion to, copper companies that have a gold kicker, or gold companies with a copper kicker, silver companies that have a copper kicker, or some of these specialty metals like antimony is red hot right now in tungsten. And if you're a gold project that has antimony, you get that double whammy. How do you look at that, or how do you value companies that are a primary metal but then touting their co-credits?
Well, I would say that a lot more companies that I have are talking about antimony, and some of them that I never knew had antimony, and probably they didn't know either. And what the idea is, like antimony is another one of these security minerals because China has banned the export of it. So it becomes a security mineral for the US, and suddenly there's funding for it and people are interested. And so it's not only funding, but it could be permitting. So I own one in Australia called Southern Cross Gold. It's now dual listed. It's in Victoria. It's a Fosterville-like mineralization, gold and antimony. And everybody knew the antimony was there. That wasn't a surprise. But in terms of what the majority of the revenue, 80% in situ, will still be gold, but that 20% of antimony will help them permit the project. You know, so it's more about that with some of these projects. It's not about, hey, we're going to make a lot of money off the antimony. Sometimes it's just about getting through a lot of the permitting red tape. It's easier once you're on that list of projects that they prioritize because of the metals you're going to produce. There's a similar sort of thing with Perpetua and their project in Idaho. You know, even though antimony might be 10% of the life of mine revenue or in-situ revenue, you know, they were going to get more than they needed in terms of their upfront capital from their funding from government agencies for that 10%, because that 10% was volumetrically very important amount of antimony that would feed the local market. But then we get into the processing side. Where is that antimony actually going to be processed? So that's another issue. But right now, yeah, things like antimony, they're important, I think, in terms of being permitted, maybe getting a little bit lower cost of capital. But still, I prefer that most of the revenue is made from a bigger metal, more liquid metal like gold, as opposed to it just being like an antimony project.
Yeah, I think you're right on that, Joe. But boy, oh boy, we're hearing everybody seems to have antimony right now, and they are a lot tying it into permitting mostly, and then also throwing around the idea of potential government funding too. We'll see how this all leads. I find permitting news and government funding, both of those for me is a more show me rather than tell me type of mood.
I would just add on the funding part, what I'd be interested to see is what happens with the Department of Energy, Department of Defense, export-import banks, any government agency in the States. Are they willing to fund outside the States like they were previously? Like, will companies in Canada see that money anymore? You know, I don't know, pre or post-annexation by the US. Well, you know, will companies in Australia see that money anymore? Or will it all just be internal? That would be another point that I would watch for.
Okay. Hey, Joe, thank you very much for sharing your insights here. We're out of time for the weekend show, but I recommend everybody clicking the link in the show notes on our podcast or YouTube page to go visit the Exploration Insights website and even look over that recent report that Joe is about to release on 2024 gold company updates in terms of growth, cash flow, all those major fundamentals that we should be paying attention to. Again, Joe Mazumdar, editor of Exploration Insights. Great having you on the show, Joe. Thank you very much for your time today.
Great. Thanks a lot, guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.